I want to get to our guest who wrote a great story for the Boston Globe. My old high school track teammate turned superstar pro runner turned historian and professor, Victoria Jackson. Victoria, thanks for the time.
Hi, Sarah. Hi, Jordan. It's awesome to be on. Thanks.
Well, this story is powerful, as most of yours are. You've written for the Globe, canceled the fall college football season, but not because of COVID-19 necessarily, rather to use that as an organic pause in order to look at the ways the system of college sports, particularly revenue-driven sports, perpetuates injustice and inequality. There are a couple lines in here that are very, you know, sort of summarize the situation quite well. And one of them is the idea that they can claim an athletic scholarship is priceless, and athletic departments field disproportionately black football teams with low graduation rates to entertain white students who too graduate and fans. It's the true definition of amateur college sports as it exists now. So they make a lot of money off the backs of predominantly black athletes who don't end up graduating or getting the student experience, while white non-revenue athletes and fans and students do. This is a through line for a lot of your stories. Why do you think specifically now is the moment to stop it altogether and address it?
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. It's the perfect time for a reckoning. And we have colleges grappling with the programming that they can do so that they can facilitate conversations among students as they return in the fall around systemic racism and, you know, building anti-racism curriculum. And I think this is a great opportunity to turn inward and think seriously and soberly about the role that college sports play in perpetuating the undervaluing of black lives. We have to think about the role that American universities themselves play as one of these institutions, and college sports certainly is a big part of that.
Yeah, Victoria, while I'd love to spend this time hearing stories about Sarah back in the day, this is such an incredible conversation and one that needs to be had. And you make a lot of fascinating points, and I hope we're able to cover them all in the span of time we have here. So I'll be short. You talk about increased revenue in college athletics. We all know about it. But it's also, you make mention of what I deem reckless spending in this sport. How does that kind of align itself with the message and the point you're making in the article?
Yeah, we've seen, as you said, an acceleration of the money being made in this system. But the money in athletics stays in athletics. And so you have to spend what you make since, you know, the labor costs for the players on the field remain artificially low. They have to be capped at scholarships. So the spending has become absurd, from the coaching salary escalation that has been documented so well by USA Today Sports, the bloating of athletics administration, and just all these new positions that have been created in the last two decades. And, of course, the facilities arms race with, like, schools building lazy rivers and hiring airline companies to have sleeping pods and locker rooms. Yeah. So, you know, it's a ticking time bomb. And I again, it's happening in American universities. This is the only place in the world where we have our elite sport development happening in higher education. It's the only place in the world where a multi-billion dollar sports industry is taking place in higher education. And I'm calling out university administration and also my fellow academics to take this seriously. And, you know, the pandemic provides the cover. It's a ticking time bomb for a variety of reasons, not just the money, but also, you know, the CTE, the amateur challenge, the players and athletes rights movement that's been growing, which has been great to see. And then, of course, you know, as we mentioned, the racially disparate educational outcomes.
We're talking to Victoria Jackson. She's a professor and sports historian at ASU. She's written for the Boston Globe a story about why the college football season should be canceled. They should use this COVID-19 pandemic to address the ways that it reinforces systemic racism. One of the things you write is that college sports means calling something educational when often it is not, in order not to classify athletes as employees so that their compensation can be artificially restricted. One of the things that keeps coming up to me as they try to consider how they'll play sports through the pandemic is the idea that they cannot separate athletes from other students without making very clear that there are two classes of student at the school. right? They can't say, well, we'll bring back athletes to participate in sports if the rest of their classmates are doing virtual study. So do you think that the ways that they might out themselves in the conversations they have about returning to sports may be the perfect pivot points for proving once and for all via their own words that these student athletes are not, in fact, students in any way?
Oh, I think that's brilliant, Sarah. Yes, and we see so many hypocritical moves like this in college sports. The ways athletes are treated categorically different from other students. This is one example of that. Some schools that are sharing COVID numbers and others that are not, because they're students and it would be in violation of HIPAA and FERPA, but then others are saying, like, they need to. I mean, it's that, but it's also, for me, we have a really important moment taking place right now in this focus, this preoccupation with the coronavirus pandemic and getting a fall season going. I worry that it's going to quash the effort to get name, image, and likeness economic rights to athletes passed from third parties. That is the big moment of reckoning we're also having right now. And there's been such a strong effort and pushback by both the NCAA and the Power Five schools to basically return NIL back to nothing at all. Bubba Cunningham at UNC has said he doesn't want any of the recommended proposals from the NCAA working group. And so here again is another way athletes are treated categorically differently from other students. Any other student on campus can make money from third parties and athletes can't. So yeah, there's hypocrisy on hypocrisy when it comes to this space.
Well, let's stay with the hypocrisy as we see these colleges, these institutions release statements expressing their renewed commitment to developing anti-racism initiatives and curriculums addressing institutional racism. Do you deem these sincere? Knowing what you know, Victoria, and in the space you work in, do you see it as sincere or lip service?
Yeah, that's exactly right, too. And, I have a lot of friends in academia who are Black and people of color and Indigenous. And I mean, they're frustrated too, seeing these statements from universities when the programs that they've tried to develop and push have been kind of shot down, or just the additional hurdles that faculty of color have to jump in order to get this type of programming done in the past. Now the universities are like all excited about doing it. So that's a frustration for a number of my colleagues, for sure.
We're talking to Victoria Jackson, herself a former collegiate athlete, and she often uses herself as an example of a white non-revenue athlete who gets to be both student and athlete and experience what is held up as the model, while the predominantly Black revenue athlete doesn't actually get to have the student experience and often doesn't even graduate. And you hold up some pretty stark numbers. For instance, at Louisiana State University, reigning national champs, Black men make up 4.6% of the undergraduate population, but 77.6% of football and basketball teams, only a third of the Black athletes are graduating. So when you look at somewhere like LSU and you were to confront anybody that buoys the current collegiate system and you point those things out, what is their usual rebuttal to why that isn't direct proof that the system is exploitative?
The common reaction when sharing those numbers, and those numbers come from Dr. Sean Harper, who's at the University of Southern California and directs the Race and Equity Center there. The predictable response I often get is, well, those athletes want to be going to college in the first place anyway, so isn't it better that they're getting some sort of education? Mm-hmm. And the way I respond to that is to kind of take a big step back and talk about how this is a reflection of the failure of residential and educational desegregation in the United States. It's a problem with our K-12 system, too, and how we've not invested enough in education across the board in the United States. We need to fund schools equally. It shouldn't be based on taxpayer monies. And I mean, Sarah, you and I know this well, having grown up in the northern suburbs of Chicago and the fantastic educational and athletic experiences we enjoyed, that shouldn't be, you shouldn't gain access to that because of your parents' wealth or the place where you live. All young people in the United States should have had the opportunities that we enjoyed. And so I see college sports as a reflection of that.
You know, one of the interesting points you make towards the end of the article, Victoria, is you talk about college sports athletic departments, a solution being to spin it off. Can you elaborate on what you mean there?
Yes, thank you. So, you know, Power Five football is categorically different, both within Power Five athletic departments, but also, you know, especially without them across the three divisions and the 1,200 schools of the NCAA. I think this is the solution. Privatization would allow schools to keep teams within arm's reach. That way they'd still kind of enjoy the marketing and community benefits that they've come to depend on. And then football players get what they deserve, especially, you know, they're playing a dangerous sport and they'd be getting paid compensation. They'd finally have unionized labor rights. And then I think the critical part of this is that in those compensation packages, we include lifetime scholarships so that these athletes also finally get the quality educational experiences they deserve. And I think, you know, if we, again, place this in longer historical context, the place to point to, well, there's two places, the Olympic movement and its transition out of amateurism. There was a fear that no one would care about the Olympics anymore if it was no longer amateurs playing, that it would lose its purity and people just wouldn't care. And that clearly has not been the case. And then the other is European football clubs. You know, these football clubs across the UK and Europe were born in the same moment as a lot of these intercollegiate athletic departments. And, you know, they have the same sort of traditions of fandom and community attachment and often very small towns, much like college towns in the U.S. And those are pro teams, and they still have, you know, they still sing all the songs and have those attachments that are generational, just like I think we would see in the United States if football programs became professionalized.
So the privatization, just to clarify, then would the athletes be students whose job is sort of the sports, or would they no longer be students at all? It would just be that those teams would exist within the community where they used to live.
Yeah, I think that the teams would be in the community. The players on those teams would have the option to enroll you know, synchronously and the same as they would otherwise, or wait and go to school in a different time or go to classes in the off season. This is something that could be worked out in that year for what it looks like on the player's end. But I think there's already a good model being built, which is the Professional Basketball League. The Professional Collegiate League, which is Andy Schwartz and his team. They're building a league that's to launch next summer. That is age group. Like this would be, going after those high-profile high school recruits, giving them an opportunity to play, also get paid, and also go to school. So it's an alternative pathway to the NBA, much like the many others that are growing, like the G League and playing overseas.